Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, who examines the proportionality of Israel's invasion of Gaza after an Israeli soldier was taken prisoner. Journalist John Ross, who reports on Mexican presidential candidate López Obrador's demand for a recount of the contested July 2nd election, in which his conservative opponent Felipe Calderón declared victory. And Mimi Abramovitz, professor of social policy at Hunter College, who discusses the consequences that punitive welfare legislation will have on millions of poor women and their children. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after British Prime Minister Tony Blair created the Commission on Africa in advance of the 2005 G8 summit in Gleneagles, the Commission has shut its doors. According to the Scotsman newspaper, after its funds were given to a United Nations panel led by Kofi Annan and anti-poverty crusader Bob Geldof, the Commission has not met in almost a year and has closed its press office. The Gleneagles summit, disrupted by the July 7, 2005 London terror attack, made a series of commitments to Africa: massive debt cancellation, new aid from wealthy nations, and trade reform, including the elimination of farm subsidies within industrial nations. Debt relief was given to 14 African nations, yet debt is still a huge burden for much of Africa. According to Africa Action, the continent's indebted nations still pay $14 billion a year in debt payments, only $1 billion less than before the G8 relief package. The G8 countries also promised to double aid to Africa to $50 billion a year by 2010. Yet, only France has lived up to its aid commitment, with England, the United States, and Italy falling behind on delivering new aid. Talks on a new agreement by the World Trade Organization have stalled, and hopes of cutting massive farm subsidies in the U.S. and Europe are slim. On Wednesday morning, July 5th, a small group of students gathered outside the National University of El Salvador to protest a recent 15% increase in electricity and a 25% rise in public transportation costs. As the crowd increased in numbers, the National Civilian Police, or the PNC, began firing tear gas. Reports stated some of the protesters possessed weapons, and there were other reports of military helicopters shooting down at the crowds. The police eventually raided and occupied the university. Two police officers and three students were killed in the confrontation. According to the Women's Global Green Action Network, Wednesday's violence follows the brutal assassinations on Sunday, July 1st, of Francisco and Juano Manjares de Manzanares, parents of Radio Venceremos co-founder Marina Manzanares, known as Mariposa. Salvadoran President Tony Saca and Minister of the Interior René Figueroa are blaming the violence on the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, or the FMLN, calling them terrorists. The Salvadoran National Assembly is currently trying to pass an anti-terrorist bill that would criminalize many nonviolent protest tactics. By claiming that such a bill could have prevented the July 5th violence, Saca and the right-wing Arena Party may be able to get the bill passed. After nearly a decade of delays, Cambodia is launching a war crimes tribunal to investigate the killing fields of the mid-1970s, in which 1.7 million people died from execution, forced labor, or starvation, nearly a quarter of the nation's population. Victims' groups are looking for an open process and truth-telling. As Yuk Chang of the Phnom Penh-based Documentation Center of Cambodia observed, the need for the victims to hear and tell their stories must be protected. The whole process is more important than the indictments. The Documentation Center has investigated the atrocities masterminded by Pol Pot's former Khmer Rouge government. It has investigated 20,000 mass graves, 189 prisons, and conducted 30,000 victim interviews. According to the Interpress Service, concern was raised about the process because of the unusual makeup of the panel, officially called the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia. The panel includes 13 international jurists and 17 Cambodian judges, but victims must wait until mid-2007 to get access to the War Crimes Tribunal. In other recent war crimes bodies in Rwanda and Yugoslavia, international jurists made up the entire tribunal in order to maintain a high standard of justice. This week's news summary was compiled by Denise Manzari and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On June 25th, Palestinian militants tunneled into Israel and conducted a raid in which they took prisoner an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit. Soon after, the Israeli army launched an assault on the Gaza Strip, Palestinian territory it had withdrawn from last year. Israeli forces took dozens of Palestinian government officials and activists prisoner, while planes and tanks destroyed bridges and the territory's electrical generating station, causing a medical crisis and shortages of food. More than 50 Palestinian militants and civilians have died in Gaza since Israel began its assault there. Hamas political leader Khaled Mashal in Syria has offered to free the Israeli soldier in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, a deal flatly rejected by Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Israel has refused to negotiate with the Hamas government, elected by Palestinians in January, as they consider the Islamic Party to be a terrorist group. Israeli officials also rejected a call by Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniya for a ceasefire, saying that Corporal Shalit must first be released and Qassam rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel must stop. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nasir Arouri, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, who examines the proportionality and repercussions from Israel's invasion of Gaza.
Well, I think the invasion that took place about 2 weeks ago, and actually in the past 3 days, 41 civilians have been killed in this invasion. And what amazes me is that very little is shown on the television and on the mainstream media, particularly about the bombing and the civilians that have been perished 2 days ago. One of these was actually an entire family, including a six-year-old daughter, which I happened to see footage of on Al Jazeera. Hamas was elected in January, and just 3 weeks ago, Hamas and Fatah signed an agreement, a document that implicitly recognizes Israel, because it is based on withdrawal and the two-state solution. It is very much a reaffirmation of the Arab League in 2002. However, this seems to have been a threat to Israel, because Israel apparently is more comfortable with Hamas and Hamas's image being that of a terrorist organization throwing bombs, suicide bombing, even though Hamas has adhered to a ceasefire for over a year now, despite repeated provocations. But Israel is not comfortable with this kind of Hamas, just like it was not comfortable with the PLO in 1982. And therefore, they decided to embark on this invasion. Actually, I think I should mention here that last week there was a news story that appeared in Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, saying that this invasion had been decided upon for many weeks. So the Palestinians, they dug this tunnel, they went in and they abducted an Israeli soldier, and that becomes a casus belli. Certainly there was no proportionality to it, and I think that if the reason was, and it is not, the freeing of the soldier, the 19-year-old soldier, the destruction of the infrastructure and the killing of civilians are not going to hasten the freeing up of the soldier and a negotiated settlement to this conflict.
Professor Nasir Arouri, tell us, if the Israeli objective here is to weaken the Hamas government, what effect do you think this Israeli invasion of Gaza will have in terms of the popular support for Hamas?
I think it might very well be counterproductive. In fact, there is already evidence that I have, just simply from talking on the telephone to people who are on the scene in Gaza, not people sitting in hotels in Jerusalem and being resource people for the LUR NewsHour and others. The sector of the Palestinian body politic, Palestinian society, that is not impressed with Hamas as a religious group, are more supportive of Hamas today than they were 3 weeks ago, for the simple reason that they see Hamas as taking really a moderate line. In fact, I think that it is a bit too moderate for certain sectors of the Palestinian community. But they see it as not overreacting and still proposing plans for diplomacy. We have not heard a single proposal from Israel for diplomacy. All they do is they say that we want to get our prisoner back.
And just a final question, Professor Aruri. How has the Bush administration reacted to this Israeli incursion into Gaza?
Well, the Bush administration actually can no longer say that it is the honest broker, nor can it even say that it is a broker. First of all, the so-called peace process has been put on ice since April of 2004, when Sharon made his last trip to Washington, held a press conference with Bush, decided to invoke what he called disengagement, and disengagement was a unilateral plan by Israel, and the U.S. acquiesced in it and in effect said there's no need for a peace process. So the peace process is not even on hold. It's really on ice. Secondly, and more importantly, the United States is in violation of international agreements, and it is in violation also of its own law. There is at least the Geneva Convention of 1949, which not only prohibits the occupying power from collective punishment, but it makes it incumbent on all signatories of the Geneva Convention, such as the United States, to see to it that other signatories, such as Israel, is not engaged in collective punishment, which is what it's doing when it cuts the electricity for 1.4 million people.
That was Nasir Aruri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. He is the author of the book, Dishonest Broker, America's Role in Israel and Palestine. His forthcoming book is titled Palestine and the Palestinians. 1 week after Mexicans went to the polls to vote for president, hundreds of thousands of supporters of Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the Party of Democratic Revolution converged on Mexico City's Zócalo or Central Square to demand a recount in one of the most hotly contested elections in that nation's history. A preliminary count had López Obrador's opponent, Felipe Calderón, of the Conservative National Action Party, winning by some 400,000 votes. A second count of the July 2nd vote narrowed the margin between the two candidates to 243,000 of the 41 million cast. But López Obrador has criticized Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute for not counting almost 1 million ballots, which poll workers claimed could not be deciphered. The candidate, a longtime advocate for Mexico's poor, laid out numerous other election anomalies and screened videotapes to illustrate what he maintains is evidence of ballot tampering. The Federal Electoral Tribunal has until August 31st to rule on López Obrador's demand for a recount. The case can also be appealed to the Supreme Court. In his Mexico City rally, López Obrador announced plans for a national march to demand a vote-by-vote recount. The protest march will conclude in the capital on July 18th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author John Ross in Mexico City, who reports on the aftermath of Mexico's contested presidential election.
On Saturday, Andrés Manuel called for marches to begin on Wednesday in all 300 of the electoral districts in Mexico, one end of the country to the other end of the country, to converge on Mexico City on Sunday, July 16th, for one more mega march through the city in an attempt to pressure the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, the what's called the Truth Day here, into opening up the ballot boxes and counting the votes one by one. This election was stolen in a lot of different ways, but one of the real ways that it can be shown who is the actual winner is to count the ballots one by one. And this has been done in a lot of other countries recently in close elections in Costa Rica and Italy and Germany, counted the votes one by one. The ruling party is, of course, reluctant to allow that to happen because they know they're going to lose. And so we have this kind of face-off right now. This country is absolutely divided right down the center between the industrial north and the indigenous, impoverished but resource-rich South. López Obrador took 16 states, and most of them in the south of Mexico. Only one state went to the PAN, and some states in the Pacific north of the country as well. And the PAN took the states in the central and northern part of the country, 16 states as well. There are more people in the south than there are in the north, so PRD now represents, in this instance, 54% of the population. This is an election that has been, from the very beginning, about poor versus rich. López Obrador's slogan has always been the poor first. Felipe Calderón represents the fat cats, represents neoliberalism, represents the pain that neoliberalism has inflicted upon this country. And the choice is obvious. It's an election that has split the country right down the line geographically, politically, economically, and racially. This is definitely a face-off between the people who are the color of the earth, as Subcomandante Marcos names them, and people who are the color of money. And it's perhaps the most vital election that Mexico has suffered through since the Mexican Revolution, and perhaps even that doesn't describe it. There's also an election all about Washington, and Washington has been plenty involved in this thing. It's an election about where Mexico stands geopolitically. Is it the continual servile policies that both the PRI and the PAN have inflicted upon this country in obeisance to George Bush in Washington? Bush has already recognized Calderon. Or will Mexico resume its traditional position as being part of Latin America and align itself with the new left democracies in Latin America? And I think that's most of all what worries Washington and Bush at this moment.
John Ross, I wanted to ask you, when you look at the allegations of fraud here and the declarations of fraud by Andres Manuel López Obrador, what's the most compelling evidence here that you see?
Well, there's a lot of compelling evidence. We began with a preliminary vote count in which the results were deliberately cooked to make it appear that Calderon won the election. 3 million votes were removed from the preliminary vote count by the Federal Electoral Institute. Its director, Luis Carlos Ugalde, he never bothered to tell anybody until he was quizzed on a morning television show and said, "Oh yeah, we put 3 million votes." It seemed to have certain inconsistencies and withdrew them from the prep. That was to give, of course, the rest of the world the idea that Calderon had won the election. The 16 states that the PRD and López Obrador took, mostly in the South, have more votes for senators and congressional representatives than they do for president. And if we look at the PAN states, the 16 states in the North, there are more votes for president than there are for senators and congresspeople. This is inexplicable. And the only way to guarantee that there is electoral democracy here is to open up the ballot boxes and to count the votes.
If López Obrador and his supporters do not get the recount that they are demanding, what are the consequences for Mexico?
Well, the consequences for Mexico are very, very serious. Calderón, if he is allowed to become president, will be a despised person, will not have any kind of control over the rest of the country. As I said, half the country is now aligned along class lines. If you could put the class war on the ballot, that's what we just had. No. So we're looking at years of resistance here. If indeed Calderón is imposed upon the people, that's going to have economic ramifications. It's going to radicalize this country. It's going to put an unstable state on your border. And it's not going to do much to alleviate the immigration problem.
That was journalist and author John Ross. His latest book is titled Murdered by Capitalism, published by Nation Books. Read Ross's articles online at www.counterpunch.org. After 4 years of controversy, tough new rules for welfare recipients were just enacted with President Bush's signing of the latest budget bill. The new regulations add more stringent work requirements to the welfare reform law passed in 1996, known as Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF. For 60 years before that, welfare was known as Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC. The program was set up in 1935 to help poor people, mostly women, take care of their children. Welfare rolls peaked in 1970 and continued their downward trend after the 1996 law was passed, as many poor women entered the workforce in a then-booming economy. But now, with a weak economy, some women are reaching the end of their 5-year lifetime limit for receiving welfare benefits. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mimi Abramovitz, a professor of social policy at the Hunter College School of Social Work in New York City. For 2 decades, she has studied how changes in the nation's welfare policies affect poor women and recently co-authored a book titled Taxes Are a Woman's Issue, Reframing the Debate, that relates tax policy to the issue of welfare reform. Abramovitz explains that in 1990, 85% of those eligible were receiving some kind of welfare assistance. Today, it's 48%. She says some women benefited from welfare reform, but the large majority of women who are no longer receiving welfare benefits are still mired in poverty. And she explains some of the thinking behind punitive welfare reform legislation.
It was decided that women were lazy, taking advantage of the program, didn't want to work, needed the strong arm of the government to push them into the labor market. And so they made the changes called welfare reform, which were these mandatory work requirements, 5 years time limit, meaning no welfare after 5 years, no matter what happens to you. It's a lifetime limit, and a variety of other stringent requirements. The argument for that was misleading, number one. And the second part of the argument, which is getting more attention today, it didn't originally, is the idea that welfare breaks up families, that rising rates of single motherhood and teen pregnancies happened because women had access to welfare benefits. But again, the data show that that's not true. The marriage rates have been declining for all women for a very long time, let's say since 1950, and continue to decline after welfare reform. So welfare reform didn't change that. And teen pregnancy rates are also declining. I mean, we want teen pregnancy rates to decline, but they're declining, and they started declining before welfare reform. So this intervention, one could argue, it was not necessary to achieve those goals. Short of that, you could say you can't take credit for those marriage trends. In terms of work, most analysts, I think, across the political spectrum say that the large part of the reduction in welfare rolls in terms of women going to work had to do with the fact that from 1996 to about 2000, the economy was booming. Industries that hired low-skilled workers were hiring at a faster rate. So, of course, more women left welfare, as they always did when jobs were available. Now that the economy is weaker, we find that in some states, where they can, women are coming back onto welfare.
I know a lot of advocates for poor women were saying that you can't just measure success by looking at how many women left the welfare rolls, but you also have to look at what happened to those women. So, in a way, wouldn't a mandatory work requirement be helpful to them to see that women actually get jobs?
The mandatory requirements are that they work. There's no mandatory requirements that anyone hires them. And, in fact, in addition to sort of forcing people into a labor market, whether there were jobs available or not, since most of the welfare recipients are women, one would think that, well, if you want to do that, you would at least provide child care. But at the same time, child care funding has been drastically reduced. Most recent budget cuts include some $11 billion, I think it's over 10 years, of underfunding for child care, according to the child care advocates.
Mimi Abramovitz, talk about your area of research and the book you just co-authored and how it relates to the question of welfare reform and the economic well-being of poor women.
Most of this research has looked at the spending side, like how government spends its money and how this money did or did not help poor women, especially the money spent on welfare. The book that you mentioned, Taxes Are a Women's Issue, Reframing the Debate, looks at the revenue side. It looks at how the money was raised or not raised over time that supports not just welfare, but all public goods and services, from transportation, libraries, roads, including and all the social welfare programs. And what we found here is that since at least 1970, if not before, the tax system, which is mostly based on one's ability to pay, called the progressive income tax system, has really been increasingly not following that principle. And more, those the more wealthy, affluent taxpayers are paying disproportionately less than, and the, sort of the tax bill is being shifted to people, to low workers, especially low-income workers. And that's been happening through various changes in the number of the tax rate and the number of tax brackets, and it's been kind of invisible. But it started to become apparent to the wider public when, in 2000, when President Bush started the tax cut campaign. And when we analyzed these tax cuts, that was sort of the final step in kind of reducing the progressivity of the tax system. But it also fell very heavily on poor women, because when you cut taxes, you don't have any money to spend on things like child care, education, social welfare programs, and so on. And so the analysis shows that the program serving the poor, in which poor women are overrepresented, sort of lost most of the money. Most of the money that was cut came from those programs. It's a vulnerable population. It's a population that's largely of color, and it's single mothers. I call this a population that everybody loves to hate, unfortunately, and are not known for voting. So the book tries to argue for the need to find ways to raise revenues so we can support a better standard of living, not just for the poor, but for everybody.
That was Mimi Abramovitz, professor of social policy at Hunter College and co-author, along with Sandra Morgan, of the book Taxes Are a Woman's Issue, Reframing the Debate. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Mandari.